who you actually nominate the chair of COVID to chair of the meeting today. May I have second for the nomination? Mr. Mazzini, would you like it? Are there any objections to the nomination?
Thank you for that proceeding with Offer for Gates. I thought his cooperative governance is members are afraid we needed to move with it in the advice of Joshua and my content processing because it's like we want to set some of the issues in the plenary today.
Tomorrow.
Or it's a later day. Or it's a later day. Which is kind of a later day. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4.
Chai, see, there's someone new in the committee. I don't know.
Oh, this is it. No. Wait. The committee met and the introduction of that is not a first person introduction. You should ask somebody to. Because your apologies, you remember that. The apology part is you to. Thinking that everyone knows him, but I'll allow this way to reintroduce our content that way.
Our members, they are now left to have Ms. Anthea van der Berg. She's adding some to the committee and in a whole mail function. She'll be our content advisor going forward. Evan Kinnett has been seconded to the PC on police.
And therefore, welcome here. Yeah. I hope your interest is not emotional. It's only public time. It's only cooperative government where that already is. I don't know. Only men, the staff men, everything men. We're not men.
Okay.
Can we start now? You welcome. Introduce ourselves. My name is Matoni Hamfrim Kosi. As you observe, the acting chair of the Committee on Security and Cultural Development. Our chairperson is attending JSC. As well as I'm sure that you know how to around the Cape Town. So I'm sitting on ECR. Our other members introduce themselves.
Chair, my name is Tunga Matila, representing the Gauteng province. I'm coming from the city, the third largest city in the world, that's called Swan. Thank you.
This is the largest city, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Chair.
Where do we just clarify that? It's called the largest city. It does not mean economic, only geography. You must not come and intimidate as well as large.
Here,
the largest province.
Yeah. No, thank you, Chairman. My name is Ewan Zumande from the city of choice, Umsunduzi. And I'm glad that now, finally, Tswane has found a nickname as well, the largest city, third largest. Only until we were in Pretoria 2 weeks ago. Thank you, Chair.
We know all. My name is Jack Becker, verweeskaap, en lid van die komitee. Kom oorspronkelijk van Oudtshoorn af, land van die gewoedvoels.
De Makasana Manzini, member of the committee. De Taille Mpumalanga. Let me carry now, think of Mako Levishin, look at that daughter, Jesu Christe, Mafura Yarsuna.
Good morning, people. I'm from, my name is John Gunda, and I'm from the North Cape, from Upington, the oldest town in South Africa, but where you get the best and friendliest people.
Okay.
Christian Dixon, I'm the committee secretary for the committee.
Thank you for the work on the department.
Well, if I want to just do it. You can take over the committee, introduce ourselves. It's a high tender. Yeah, well, let's take over.
Thank you. Acting Chair, honorable members, I am Major General Paco from the South African National Defence Force, based in Pretoria, City of Tshwane. We are here down with the Secretary of Defence, the DG, but as you know, he's also here in another meeting which commences at the same time. So he asked us to apologize on his behalf, but he also tasked us to represent him here in terms of the presentation that was given to the committee, Civil Committee on Security and Constitutional Development. I'm here with Colonel Pete Adams, who is also a staff officer in the South African National Defence Force. He's also based in Pretoria. That's the only answer. With your permission, if you accept, we thought we were the person on the agenda, can we then get on to the presentation? Thank you, sir. As we know, the SEC Committee on Security and Constitutional Development has asked the Minister of Defense and military veterans, Ms. Nasibe Nota and Makisa Makula, to bring to this committee the presentation, which is a briefing by the Department of Defense on the employment of the South African National Defense Force for servicing cooperation with the South African Police Service. Specifically, this is in the period around the visit of the United States of American President Obama, during the period 28 June 2013 to 01 July 2013. So as we know, the Department of Defense is not a new department in terms of security issues around the visiting head of state. It is the South African Police. We are assisting as defense. And Colonel Peter also will do the presentation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Is it all? Is it that?
No. Okay. Chair, I'd like to check in terms of the defense as we haven't as a committee looked at the accounting officer. I'm not sure who's the accounting officer. And the Secretary of Defense, and in terms of that office, the CFO and all those people, are those positions in place? Because you see, when we had National Services, we had a lot of filling staff. Now, we haven't checked that in as far as defense is concerned. I just wanted to check because, you know, we have the privilege today to have the defense force here in terms of ranking, leadership, who is here. Thank you, Chair.
Chadine, there are schedules for this meeting to do this specific job to this SSD. As the officer explained, Chair, that they are presenting this in terms of the unique and special task that they did, and they are required to do that before to Parliament. It was, as they said, specifically to deal with matters that relates to their services or tasks they carried out in support of the SAPS during the visit of the President of the United States. And the presenter is saying that Kenneth Lawrence will then do the presentation, the health presentation. So I think let's proceed in that light. But we are, Honorable Matila is correct, that we, in our program, at some point, we do need to have the Secretary of Defense to take us through some of the activities and the structure that they are operating with and other related matters to this department. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Acting Chairperson and members of the Select Committee. I'm briefly going to give you an overview of the visit that took place over the period of 28th June till July, 1st of July 2013. And the aim is then to give you an overview of what happened during that visit as we, under the Constitution, cooperate with the South African Police Service and in support of the other departments involved during this visit. As you know, is that DIRCO is actually the main lead department during this official visit of President Obama to South Africa. The scope is basically the background of the visit, the planning process we followed, the taskings we received as the National Defence Force, the resources we allocated, the command and control that took place, the airspace management and the financial estimate during the planning process. The background is that President Obama arrived on the 28th of June at Able Space Waterloo. Now before that there was a lot of activities that took place. As you know, that when the President of the United States traveled around, he fly in all his vehicles and all his water and everything beforehand, and everything took place at through Air Force Base Waterloo, and everything took place under the lead of DIRCO. And they presented us with the necessary diplomatic notes to the Chief National Defence Force for the cooperation on that thing. On the 28th to the 15th of June, there was a presidential meeting between President Obama and President Zuma. President Obama then also visited the city of Johannesburg, the University of Johannesburg, the Soweto campus specifically, and there was a state banquet in short in Pretoria. And then in the Western Cape, then he got down on the Western Cape on the 30th, and he left on the 1st of July the morning, and he visited Robben Island and the Desmond Tutu Foundation. During the travel of the President, as further background, President Obama now, he mainly traveled by air. They brought in their own helicopters, which they assembled at Air Force Base Waterloo, at their own expenses and things like that. And then if plan B, if they can't fly, they went by road. So there's always a plan A and B, as you know. The planning process, the first planning process took place on the 15th of June 2013 at the OR Tambo facility of DIRCO in Pretoria, and it was chaired by the DD of DIRCO at that stage. And from that, we then formed the NAT joint instructions was sent out on the 13th of June, and then on the 9th of June we established an aviation subcommittee, which is responsible to make sure that the coordination for the in the aviation part is running smoothly between Department of Transport, Department of Defense, DIRCO, and the Secret Service of the United States. And everything was done under the lead of DIRCO at all the slides and meetings. Then the SANDF put out, we did outlining and put out our operational directive on the 21st of June, and in that directive we also requested presidential authority as is constituted in the Constitution Section 2012A, that only the President can put us in service in cooperation with the police. So we went through that process and everything went well. Our final coordination meeting was on the 25th of June, and the final headquarters meeting on the 27th of June, and then the visit started the next day on 28th. Our task teams, specifically our SANDF task teams, we had ground force support in the Western Cape, meaning one infantry platoon versus the South Africa Police Service by manning the high grounds to act as observation posts to see if there's any funny movement or suspicious movement going in and around Robben Island specifically, and then in the harbour area where the president stayed. Air, we did the air space management, and we did some trooping of high-risk forces. That is the planning, to do the trooping of high-risk forces in case we need it. Those high-risk forces are from the police. And then everything was run from airport base Waterproof in the beginning. The rest of the air took place from Cape Town International Airport, which does not fall under the SANDF's mandate and was run through ASA. The maritime security in Cape Town was also established, and that is mainly in and around the harbour and Robben Island to cover that area, and I will go in more detail a little bit later. And then the Presidential Medical Support Unit was responsible also, as it is a head of state visiting South Africa, to liaise with the visiting head of state's team and make sure that all the necessary medical support are available as well as whatever is required for the visit. And then there was the command and control on national as well as provincial level. The resources allocated, as I said, in the Cape is one platoon in the Western Cape. We got we put two Oryx helicopters on standby in Gauteng and also assist the SAPS if and when required. And we did some trooping at the end with those two helicopters in both provinces. And then there was also the two helicopters down in Cape Town. Although the President flew with his own helicopters, we did the pre-placement of the SAPS members before the President went to a certain place, like for instance Robben Island. We placed the police out there and the Secret Service by their own helicopter, and then the President came, and when the President withdrew from Robben Island, we withdrew the people by helicopter. That's basically what it really means. And then maritime, we used one frigate in the region of Robben Island, and two harbour patrol boats, mainly, as I said, offshore patrol and harbour patrol, and also to cover the airspace behind the mountain, because from Cape Town International, due to the mountain, you cannot cover the area effectively 100%. So we use the frigate also to cover the airspace in case there are any suspicious movement. And then we placed one operational diving team on standby in case we need them at some space. Then Surgeon General, the medical unit in Gauteng and Western Province, where they work, as I already explained, and then the chemical, biological and radiation detection team on standby, if and when required. Luckily, we did not require. In total, we plan for 308 people to be used during a visit, and we only use 308 people during this visit in the two provinces. The command and control, the NAT joint's national job, Joint Operational Center in Pretoria, was active as we started from the planning until the visit was completed, and then the PROSDOC in Gauteng and Western Cape during the period of the visit. We allocated also at Waterproof and the harbour here in Cape Town, what we call a HOC. It's an operational center at a specific venue, a venue operational center, to make sure that the command and control between the different departments are running smoothly, during the visit. Then the airspace management, we closely liaise with the ATNS, the Air Traffic Navigation Services, and there was no air restriction proclaimed over any area, Gauteng or Cape. And then although there was a cautionary note that was published by the South African Civil Aviation Association of South Africa. So that's all that happened there. And we made sure that there are South African Air Force members as liaison officers in both provinces, even when required. And then we monitored the airspace in the area where the President moved 24 hours a day. The financial expenditure, as it is predicted there, if the personnel cost was just over 54,000 rand, and the goods and services just over 170,000 rand, total expenses as an estimate was estimated at 228,000 the presentation, Mr. Chair. Is there any questions?
Thank you very much for the presentation. Short. Is there any questions?
No, thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the presentation, which was short and direct to the point. Chair, if I am out of order, you will call me to order. During this particular visit, the fortunate part is I live in Pretoria, in Israel. And I had to interact with some senior police officers. I could not understand that when our president travels abroad, what was put in place for President Obama in this particular country? What's the difference? Because, you know, if other presidents come to, Jonathan was here, the president of Nigeria. There was nothing special about it. Now, why have you go? Do we have to go to this land on this special weekend around the government of the United States? I just want some clarity around this specific matter, so that we have to understand why must we treat him differently from other presidents. And I know, as you rightfully said, 2 weeks before his arrival, there were a lot of helicopters, cars, and everything else. What is wrong with our South African resources? Because other presidents use South African resources. Now, I want to understand what is so much special about that situation. Thank you, Chair.
That is the question. If it is political, you refer it to a question. But is it technically penal?
Thank you, Honorable Chair and members. I would not even attempt to want to answer this question. Like we said, the lead department is DECO, and the lead on security issues is the police. Of course, there's processes that would go on in terms of there's other lead departments involved, including intelligence. And they do a threat assessment, and you know, there's many other factors. And I think the result of that, as a result of their own appreciation, they would then determine how big is a threat to the individual visiting South Africa. This is no attempt to try to answer it. I'm just saying that it is not ever level to be able to tell you correctly. I'm just stating one of the processes that needs to try and determine. I think there are kind of analysis, but also some additions in terms of just trying to clarify. You've got the diplomatic note here which will quote directly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may just add to the general, all the requests concerning this visit was done by the Embassy of the United States, the diplomatic note to DECO. And these diplomatic notes are then sent to all the departments. And this is a joint decision by the NASLOIDS as well as the Deputy Instructor to run the operation this way. So I cannot really answer it except to give you this technical layout. This is where how that visit initiated and where we, why we did all everything as said. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Are we fine?
No, thank you, Chair. I think I'm partly covered. My worry is the cost that goes with the entire operation. Using 308 people, and 80 something people, that's what, or 308, I'm not sure. Yeah. And that's what you indicate, in as far as the operation is concerned. You know, I'm worried about that specific cost, because I'm saying other presidents, when they come to this country, I use defense operates the air space and security of our own country. That's the army, that's defense. Now, the police, and we had a lot of other problems. And that's the reason why I'm directing this specific question. I don't want to refer to those specific problems, that there was an outcry in this particular country around those specific problems. Now, if we treat one specific president differently from the rest of the world, that brings some challenges to us as a country. And therefore, you know, we need to also understand the cost linked to it, to that particular process, you see. Yeah. And that's the point I'm trying to raise. I know it's not your responsibility. The police will come here, I'll do the same thing. I understand. But I'm just saying, you know, internationally, what is it that we want to portray as this country to the rest of the world?
Thank you, Honorable Ruth.
No, thank you, Chair. Chair, I think some of these issues go to the joint defense. Some of us will sit to the joint defense. Such questions have been raised there relating to, you know, and I think the officers have generally made what is normally an understanding that other presidents to ask for help. Remember the CAR, that was top. When he came here, he would ask everything. So it's by request, and this is a response that was given to us at the JC, the Joint Defense. Like, it's by request, it's by circumstantial situation, as it were. But also, Chairperson, you know, one day when we debate in the committee, one of the views in terms of this situation, where do you want, who, you know, really would want Americans not monitor them? They run all over the show, they set up their own security, and nobody. So in one way or the other, at a personal level, I would add that it was a good thing that we are even monitoring them, you know, we are even securing ourselves, because as their enemies would want to find them here, it can have far-reaching implications for us as well. So it's important, you know, you will find Al-Shabaab hitting here at the waterfront, looking for Obama when he's not there. So the security that was is not in vain, in my view, the value is even to the country itself, to protect itself, because this high-profile person is around here, has enemies that are not from South Africa, elsewhere, that might be looking for help, but in our own. So I think we need to take it that way. So, and say, Chair, we, for the purposes of this, I'm proposing that as a committee we note the report, and to that end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are taking that approach.
Chair, having listened to my colleague on demand, I want to propose that we agree and adopt the approach.
Any second?
Makassar.
I second.
Any objection? They have got adopted.
In that connection, can I read the resolution?
Report of the State Culture and Security and Cultural Development on the Government of South African Nation State Force for since incorporating the government of the Rhine in accordance with the provision section 201, subsection 2, subsection 8 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, 1996, dated 9/2/2022. The State Culture and Security and Cultural Development have considered the requirement of South African Minister Defence Force for service in cooperation with the South African police and having been briefed on the employment and cost implications, report that the committee is satisfied with the employment of the for the period 28 June 2020 to 1st June 2030 to 1st July 2030. Do we hear this? Thank you very much. There is the resolution adopted, and therefore the alliance conference refers to what?
No sir, that's the report that we have, no any other report. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for briefing. And you also noted the heavy questions as you go to higher committee, you also say, hey, if you send us stay with this. Thank you very much, thank you very much. And then we just say,
thank you, sir. Sir, just a last request. Maybe would ask for a signed copy of the report. A signed one.
Car on heat. It does not sit straight. And eventually,
yesterday when he left us here, but you allowed him to ask a question for yesterday about our new diploma. And of which
I called him to order, as I said, for the benefit of knowledge. Taking away from that as committee members and not with the department. Please, let's handle our things. Honourable members, let me welcome the department, delegation from the department.
Hello, the honourable member chair is disturbing this out of court.
Sure. Okay. let's welcome the department of justice. And maybe for the sake of the court, introduce ourselves to them to us as a token of parliamentary welcome. My name is Maitone Hamzumokon, ex-chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Tunga Mandila, representing the province of Gauteng, coming from the third largest city in the world. So that is Seoul.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Chair. My name is Louis Mann, member of the committee from the KwaZulu-Natal province, the city of choice, Peter Madison. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Jack Becker. I'm from the Western Cape and a member of this committee.
Morning, everybody. I'm Veli Makasa Manzini, a member of this committee, and I'm from Mpumalanga, where the sun rises. Thank you.
Morning. My name is Ndwekwana Zulu, a member of the Kingdom of KwaZulu.
Goedemorgen. Ik ben John Gunda, ik ben in Noordkamp. En als Afrikaans ben ik in Noordkamp.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman. Dr. Van Dixon, Committee Secretary for Committee.
Thank you for the welcome to the
back. Cool. When you come, just can.
The department will take over introduction and the
thank you. Thank you, Chairperson and members of the Honourable Committee. It's an honour and privilege for us to be here. My name is Raj Dyer, and I'm with the Rules Board. I'm the Secretary to the Rules Board. My colleague will introduce himself. His name is Jay Balkishan, and he's part of the Secretariat. And he's a principal state law advisor, and he is the person that is responsible for the drafting of the cut rules, and he will talk to the rule. And our task, Chairperson, would be to give a background as to what do these rules mean for us in South Africa. What is the appeal rules? And maybe when Mr. Balkishan does the input would be just to talk very briefly on the Rome Statute, and what implication it has for South Africa, and then lead on to the issue of the appeal rules and why was it necessary to actually have those appeal rules, and where does the rules spot fit into that process, and then for the committee then to understand exactly what the importance of draft rules is, and for us just maybe to deal with one or two questions or whatever questions they are for clarity thereafter. And that would be my recommendation. And without any delay, then I will ask Mr. Balkishan just to lead us into that discussion.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Committee Members. I am Jay Balkishan from the Rules Board, which is part of the Legislative Development Unit of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. Mr. Dyer and I work together. He is the Chief Writer of the office. Honourable Chairperson, I'll take the cue from you as soon as you're ready for me to lead discussion on the topic on the agenda. Do I have your permission? Go ahead, sir. Chairperson and committee members, what I'd like to do for your benefit is to outline what the International Criminal Court is and what the Rome Statute is. The International Criminal Court was brought into law on the 1st of July 2002 by the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. It was subscribed to by a number of states that were parties to this convention, and upon 60 signatories, the International Criminal Court was formulated. What was required of the Rome Statute is that party states assist the International Criminal Court in the prosecution of certain crimes against human rights. And those crimes are crime of genocide, war crime, and crime against humanity. There's also a fourth category of crime that is not defined in the Act itself, and that is simply a broad category of crime against human rights. South Africa brought into local law the International Criminal Court, assistance to the International Criminal Court, by implementation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court Act, Act number 27 of 2002, and that came into force on the 18th of July 2002. For purposes of brevity, I refer to it as the Implementation Act. And the principal acts that constitute the International Criminal Court, we can refer to that as the Rome Statute. The International Criminal Court has its main seat in The Hague, but the Rome Statute provides, and our local statute also provides, that the court can have seats in other countries, and in our law specifically, there's provision for a seat in this country. The purpose of the International Criminal Court is to prosecute perpetrators who have committed these crimes, and those are after the 1st of July 2002. What is required of member states is to assist the criminal court, the International Criminal Court. But what is very important to note is what is referred to as the concept of complementarity. What this concept entails is that individual party states are entitled to exercise their own jurisdiction and try these suspects or accused persons accused of these crimes in their own local courts. Put differently, what it means is South Africa, as a republic, is quite entitled to try a person in a court in this country designated by the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. The International Criminal Court prosecutes persons where either the member state is not in a position to investigate and prosecute, or for international relations reasons does not wish to do so because it may not be strategically viable to do so. That is when the International Criminal Court investigates and prosecutes perpetrators. It is also empowered to do so by the UN. the UN decides that a particular person needs to be investigated and prosecuted, it can issue a directive to the International Criminal Court. Section 10 of our local statute provides basically for assistance to the International Criminal Court, where what it does and what it says is that if there's a request from the International Criminal Court to extradite a person suspected of committing any of these crimes, then South Africa, being a republic, being a member state, will have to cooperate. And that section, section 10 of the local act, implements that and enforces it. What happens locally is that the National Director of Public Prosecutions will have the person suspect arrested and brought before a magistrate's court. A magistrate, after making certain inquiries, will then, if he or she is satisfied that the person needs to be extradited, or, well, not so much that, but is satisfied that the requirements of Section 10 of our local statute are complied with, then that magistrate will make an order for the surrender of that person to the International Criminal Court and an order for the committal of that person to prison pending the decision of the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. The opposite is also possible, and that is that the magistrate may not make such an order. The purpose of Section 10, one of the purposes of Section 10 of the Local Act, is to allow a person who's accused to appeal against an order for his or her committal to prison. And it also allows the National Director of Public Prosecutions to appeal against the refusal of the court to make an order for the committal of that person to imprisonment and surrender to the International Criminal Court. What is important to note and to understand is that Section 10 of the Local Act, when I say Local Act, the Implementation Act, is aimed, the appeal procedure there is aimed only at extradition processes. That appeal procedure is not aimed at an instance where a person is tried and convicted. If a person is tried and convicted in a designated court in the Republic, then if that person wishes to appeal, he or she must follow the normal procedures provided for in the rules of the High Court. So that person would be tried in a High Court, and if that person wishes to appeal to a full court or the Supreme Court of Appeal, then those rules would have to be followed. So these rules that have been produced are exclusively for instances where extradition process is put in place. It is, at the risk of repeating this, it's not an instance where a person has been tried and convicted. The Implementation Act requires, Section 10A of the G requires that the appeal process must be of an expeditious nature. And the rationale behind that seems to be that there's deprivation of a person's liberty. So therefore, a person who is committed to prison pending his or her extradition to the International Criminal Court is given the right to appeal quickly. The Act itself provides for the appeal to be noted within 7 days, and of course it enjoins the Rules Board for Courts of Law to prepare rules of appeal procedure. Very briefly, I won't go through all of the rules in great detail. I'll leave that more for questions if that is deemed necessary. What would happen there in broad outline is that a person who has been committed to prison would note an appeal. The magistrate would then give reasons. Thereafter, the record would be transferred from the magistrate's district court to the High Court, or to the register of the High Court, who will place this before a judge, who will then deal with the matter on an urgent basis. That's in very broad outline the process. The opposite is also the same. In other words, if the director of public prosecution is unhappy where a magistrate refuses to make an order of committal surrender, then the DPP can also appeal, and the same process is afforded to the DPP. the rules of course have provision, for example, for address for service, method of service, and those kind of technical details. So, Honourable Chairperson, that is the purpose of these appeal rules. And as I indicated in broad outline, that is what the International Criminal Court is constituted for, and the Local Implementation Act is mainly to assist the International Criminal Court in the prosecution of these crimes. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Is there any addition from the colleagues? No addition? Is there anything you want to add? Thank you. Honorable Martina?
Thank you very much, Chair. One thing that I want to have a clear understanding, who are the member states who subscribe to this International Criminal Court? Now, Chair, I'm asking this precisely internationally. There's an outcry that African countries are the most affected. And we follow international law. You have countries like Israel who, you know, do whatever they want internationally, who are not even brought before this international court. You have countries in Africa, when they protect their own states, are subjected to international law. When they protect their own states in Africa. Now, I'm not sure. Once I hear and understand this particular process, is this harm for Africa alone? Are we obliged to follow this international? Because the Americans, if they think they want to protect their own country, they do as they wish internationally. They do as they wish. Nobody calls them to order. Now, I'm just saying, because that's what they do in the whole world. Now, I want to understand, why are we obliged as South Africans to follow those procedures and be part of this international, because that's why I want to understand who are the traders of this international procedure. Thank you.
And to as you answer the question, you must also link it with the withdrawal of Kenya, the resolution taken by Kenya to inform from the ICC. Okay, what are the consequences?
Honorable Chairperson, to you. I can start by indicating that currently there are, I think, 136 states, to the best of my knowledge, that are party states to the Rome Statutes. They have become party states because their respective governments have agreed to do so. In our instance, our government has also done so. And what it has also done is brought into our law the International Criminal Court by passing the implementation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, BICON. There are a number of states that are not parties to this convention, and therefore they are not obliged to assist BICON, the International Criminal Court. However, as I indicated earlier, the UN has a prerogative initiate an investigation through the International Criminal Court. it is not possible to indicate how many states in Africa are in fact member states, and those that are not members, why they have not become members. The same would apply internationally.
If I could just add, one of the biggest nations that are not part of this is the USA, which we know. It's not perfect, but I mean, I have a listing alphabetically on the various countries that are part of this, and I think maybe it's easier maybe just to look at those that are not. And one glaring one is probably the USA. That is not part of it, and I think our Honourable Chile is making the point from a perspective of whether there is some negativity that might possibly flow from African states that are part of being signatories to the Rome Statute, and is their perception real or otherwise that the International Criminal Court seems to be busy with its prosecutions against African states and its citizens, and why is it that way? And I think that really talks to a political process from our perspective in terms of the rule. Our input will be limited to the obligation that South Africa has as a signatory to the Rome Statute. And what does that have in terms of our obligations for any rules that needs to be drafted to give effect to any processes to which we are signatory, similarly to our international obligations with GATT, and what does that really mean? And so from that perspective, the Rules Board would be limited to deal specifically with regard to a rule that deals with an appeal procedure to an existing implementation act that we are a signatory to. So I do appreciate the comment, but really I suppose in fairness to us as drafters of rules within the Department of Justice, we must limit our response to that aspect and not deal with the politics of it. This will be a difficult terrain for us to pass a comment on. But I can go through the whole list of countries alphabetically if the committee so wishes for me to do so. But I'm guided by you, Chair.
And yes, how many African states in that
country? Offhand, Chair, I cannot say. But if I go through in each of the categories, there would certainly be African states within it. But I don't have the quick answer as to how many. I can find that out, and I can certainly give a more comprehensive response to the committee secretary that could be passed on to the committee. But I do have a list of the various signatories here.
Chair. You see, often we have some approaches that South Africa is good at. Can you sit down? Can you sit down and listen?
My child is more important than this meeting now.
And then from Gunda, they'll say, can I do my request when you move up?
Oh, Chair, very often, Chair, we as politicians have been asked to deal with and precisely because the Department of Justice come with a lot of things. Sometimes we think that some of these issues, and you take the Dwane case, the British are delaying a process around the murder case in South Africa. We expedite, and that's where our worry comes in, because foreign
countries have, I think there are procedures. when the church has...
Sorry, Chief, interrupt you.
I want you to do that with request for apology so that we are able to attend to the crucial issues. So that when you are in a meeting, you are in a meeting, and when you are committed, be committed, ask for apology so that we are able. Thank you.
Chair, I'm just saying this precisely because, you know, the particularly when we go towards elections, there are a lot of things that we must pass, ethically, from the Department of Justice. And I understand the free procedure. You know, that works for international countries, other countries, and does not work for us. And I just cited the Duane case now. And I've cited two countries, the US, you have indicated rightfully that it's not part of this international process. Israel is killing people daily. No? They are not part of this international convention. Why is it necessary for other South Africans to be part of that situation?
I think members and associates have also correct that question, just the objective that was who tend not to be associates, especially with the military. But I wanted to say, he didn't answer the question I asked. Okay, there's membership, there's IT process, there's all sorts of things. What happens when a member withdraws? By this meeting, what are the implications?
Thanks. You know, we understood that the international instruments generally, unless they are due for renewal, I think we're trying to ask a technical question here, and you know, in terms of the legalities, when you are a state party and the treaty on course. Normally these treaties, the articles, there's no provision. I think the officials would agree with me. There are no provisions in the drafting of the treaties, even the rules, giving expression to the treaties of withdrawal. So the importance of your question is, I think, you're trying to look at the issues of, you know, how do you then withdraw? Do you withdraw because you feel offended? Do you withdraw because now your situation has changed? Because we know that the process of signing in is always open. You know, it happens as you wish and as you feel you are ready to sign. But what happens in a situation where you want to withdraw because it's not provided for unless the treaties or the instruments are due for that in that phase of renewal or of taking of review and that kind of thing, which is what the UN system does. Thank you.
Perhaps just I have picked up that there are 33 African countries that are signatories, and I will send to the committee secretary, you know, which 33 countries, African countries, those are. Just to answer the initial question. Of course, we know about the challenges of Kenya as well as Zimbabwe. So, but I think generally the concern among African countries in regard to this is whether the International Criminal Court has been set up to prosecute mostly perpetrators or alleged perpetrators within the African continent as opposed to international, and that is what the concern from the African countries are. And I'm certain the honourable allude to that issue. For our purposes,
we are bound by that international treaty, by those obligations, and any rules that flow from being that signatory is what will adjoin us on an ongoing basis. So this particular issue, this relates in substance to an appeal procedure which Mr. Balkish has just outlined, when it will kick in.
Chairperson, believe there are two distinct processes. One is an international agreement process between states, but agreements are not binding on the citizens of the state unless and until the agreement is introduced into the state by law. So what happens at the level of the International Criminal Court and what is referred to as assembly states, that's an agreement. The states agree to become members or they agree to withdraw, or they withdraw. But in our instance where the law has been, or the agreement has been enforced into our law, then we are bound by it. So that's the major difference. So one is at the level of an agreement, and the other one, locally, is at the level of law that is enforced in the country. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, we just have recently dealt with the State Information Bill. Internationally, there was an outcry around South Africa to move in that direction. Immediately in the United States, one of the army people gets arrested and sentenced. There was quietness. But it is said South Africa cannot protect itself from international interference. Now, the question I raised earlier, that why is it that in a country the Justice Department forces us to move with speed around international interventions or international laws? Why must we be bound by the Roman law? Whilst people who move with speed in protecting their own countries, the United States, the Israelis, whatever, are not bound by that. Now, I'm saying the Justice Department in particular, precisely because, you know, we are forced to move with speed as this African country. We can release people on with speed. I've just made an example now. We've been sitting in the Diwali case for almost a year. He can't be transferred to South Africa. Precisely the British are protecting him. You see? Now, you come to us here as lawmakers to force us to deal with this matter speedily. And I'm asking this question. Why must we not protect South Africans, but protect international people? You see? And this is the question I'm trying to find. We want to be internationalists. Thank you, Chair.
Can we note that question is voluntary? I will take it to the conference of the ruling party. So I think we're done. Can we move for adoption?
Chair, I just need some more clarity before we adopt this resolution, this international agreement.
I think Committee Whip will assist us to handle this agitators.
Yeah. Can I maybe assist the committee to put the issue in perspective? South Africa is a signatory to the Rome Statute, which then enjoins the country insofar as international criminal court is concerned. Now, that debate and that decision is a decision
to whether why did we sign, why are we signed off, and we must rule out if that is an argument to be made. And it's an area that the rules board, who we represent within the Department of Justice, has got no jurisdiction. But what?
Hey, just on a point of order, can I move for the adoption and move the process? I think he's becoming a politician now.
And also our concept advice that the current subsidy will be taken just to bring us in more detail. But now there is a sound of the mover in my side. Thank you. Oh, they are signatories of ICC. Again, I think we thank you very much from the board for the briefing engagement. We are every moment we get educated through questions and answers. And thank you for that. Thank you very much.
Chairperson and members of the Honourable Committee, thank you very much for the vibrant discussion. And we appreciate your coming, accommodating us for the session. And I will send the information that I undertook to send to the committee secretary. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and committee members. It was inspiring.
You said you don't want to do it here. Alright, can I read the report of the State Committee on Executive Cost Development on the Rules of Appeal Procedures made by the Rules Court for Court of Law in accordance with Section 10 of Section 8 of Section J of the Implementation of the Rome Circuit of the Interdisciplinary Court Act 2002, number 27, 2002, and tabled for approval by Parliament in terms of Section 10, Section 8, Section 8 of the Act, dated 9 October, 2015. The State Committee of Executive Conduct Development, having considered the rules of appeal procedure, made by the Rules Board for Court of Law, in accordance with Section 10, Section 8, Section J, of the implementation of Rome Statute of the Court Act 2002, number 27 of 2002, and tabled for approval by Parliament in the 10th of Section 10, Subsection 8, Subsection H of the Act, recommended by the Legislative Council of Province approves the rules of public procedures.
Can I move?
Seven. Rebecca? Thank you very much. Let's welcome now medical aid, is it a board or guide for approval? Is it a board?
Legalize South Africa, Jay.
Or legalize South Africa. Let's welcome. You are welcome. My name is Matuma Abdul Mohammed, the acting chair on behalf of our chair who's attending SC. I would request members to also introduce themselves. Thanks.
Thank you, Jay. Tumka Mantira, coming from the third largest city in the world, called Swani, from Gauteng. Thank you.
Good morning, thank you, Chair. My name is Lewin Zimande from KZN, member of the committee.
Which city are you
from? Oh, the city of choice.
My name is Jack Becker. I'm a member of the committee and I'm a delegate from the West Africa.
Which city?
So, come to the big first.
Thank you, Chair. His name is Gordon Dixon. I'm the committee secretary for the committee.
I just want to go to the side.
Thank you. You're welcome. We will introduce ourselves and take over the part presenting.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Patrick Handemark. I am the Chief Legal Executive at Legal Aid South Africa. Alright, I'd like to introduce yourself.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Sapang Molare. I'm a legal support practitioner. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You can now take the legal present.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, firstly, apologies from our chairperson, our deputy chairperson. Judge Mlango is appearing before, at the Judicial Service Commission today to interview specifically for his court. He would otherwise have been present, so he asked me to tender his apologies. Our deputy chair, Judge Molo Flair, is in Boston at the moment, so also his apologies. And our CEO is in the city of Tzaneen. And so apologies from her.
Okay, the city of Tzaneen. That's where I come from. Can I just interrupt? As small as you start up, that's where I come from. Yeah.
Maybe we should place on record where we're from. I'm from a little city called Port Elizabeth, although I now live in Gauteng.
And Mr. Mnare, yeah. And I'm from Joel.
I thought it was Macaulay. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to present to the committee. The committee should have, Chair, just as an introduction, a full draft legal aid guide, which is quite a thick document. That's the proposed document that contains all the amendments that it would read with the amendments. But obviously, to make it easier for committees to go through a document that thick, which you've previously dealt with and approved, we've then reduced specifically and gave a detailed document that sets out a summary of all the amendments. You'll see it's in a table format that sets out what the current provision is, what the proposed provision is, and if there is no current provision, obviously, then it will just be a proposed provision. And that is then the detailed amendments, and we'll see wherever there's a deletion, we'll delete it, or whether an insertion is underlined. But that is in the detailed amendments. The third document is then just a Word document, which is a summary and give you a broad outline of what all those detailed amendments are, and that's really what I will deal with and go through in terms of our PowerPoint presentation here. So it's just in terms of the overall documentation that you do have. And then, Chair, before we start presenting, I would just like to say we've given to the committee secretary what we call the client's version of a legal aid guide to distribute a document of a couple of hundred pages to the public does work. So we've translated the client's version of the guide into 6 languages at the moment, and we've made available copies thereof, and we also have printed significant numbers that we can make available to the committee, and it's a smaller pamphlet. And that then just in brief terms sets out the means tests, the methods we can assist with, and where they can make contact with us, specifically at our call centre and the one contact number. The second document is a booklet of impact litigation, which is in
significant litigation that we've been involved in over the last financial year, wherein we set out the cases and the different principles that we try to establish in either funding or being part and being the attorneys in litigating those issues before our courts. So I just thought into a bit of information for the committee as to some of the work that we've done and that are available for the committee. And if anyone requires more, we'll happily make available. Chair, if I can proceed, our overall presentation, the overview of the presentation, you can see really that there's four main issues, but we'll deal briefly with our mandate. I won't linger long there. Then just in terms of the requirements of the legal aid guide and the requirement to ratify. Then we'll deal with the committee in terms of the amendments sought to the guide, and we've broken that up into basically six broad categories, being criminal matters, civil matters, commissions of inquiry. Then there's just two miscellaneous issues. The third one has been supply chain management requirements, specifically in obtaining the legal services for clients. And then the last issue will be the means test. And then just to conclude, Tsipanga and I will be alternating between ourselves in terms of which slides we present, so that you don't get bored with just one of our voices. As you would know, Legal Aid South Africa's mandate comes both from the Constitution of the Supreme Law. There are specifically three very clear provisions relating to legal representation at state expense. That is Section 35(2) of the Constitution, which deals with detained persons, Section 35(3), which deals with accused persons, and then Section 28(1)(h), which then deals with civil legal aid in respect of children. Then in addition to that, obviously there is Section 3 of the Legal Aid Act that gives a broader mandate, which also then includes then making legal aid available to indigent persons and to provide representation at state expense contemplated in the Constitution. There are also other pieces of legislation that do require us to provide legal representation. I haven't gone into the detail, but that's the overall mandate from Legal Aid South Africa perspective. Chair, then, just in terms of the Legal Aid Guide, as we know, the Legal Aid Act doesn't detail who should qualify for legal aid assistance, what kind of matters legal aid should be available in. What the Act provides is that the objects the details of and the procedures for the administration of legal aid should be detailed in a document called the Legal Aid Guide. In terms of Section 3(A)(2), we are then required to submit this to our executive authority, being the Minister of Justice, who will then table before the National Assembly, and unfortunately we still have an old act, which is hopefully becoming one of those documents coming from the Department of Justice that need to go through this year in terms of our new Legal Aid Act. The bill has been finalised and has been approved by Cabinet. It says the Senate, which obviously we now read as the National Council of Provinces, for ratification. And pending the ratification of the guide, that's in operation remains. The 2012 Legal Aid Guide was ratified both by the National Assembly, in that instance on the 20th of September, and for the National Council of Provinces on the 24th of November 2011. We then have 3 months from that date to print it and then bring it into operation, which duly happened on the 23rd of February 2012. So what we propose to do is then to move through and take the committee through the amendment that we propose to the current legal aid grant. I think that's fine to deal with the first part of amendments here.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think the first amendment that we sought is from a criminal case. And what we have done is we have included children as a category of persons who are entitled to legal aid under the Constitution. And this was based or influenced by the Child Justice Act 35 of 2008. And what we have done also is we've made an amendment that when a child appears in a child justice court, that such child must not be refused legal aid, even where a matter is not listed for the district court. The other amendment that we are sorting is that we are extending legal aid for children in a preliminary investigation. That investigation is very important because it is regarded as the first appearance of the tax. And it's also important because we want to ensure that a child is not lost in the system. That is why we want to provide legal aid at that instance. And the other amendment I was hoping is that where a client was represented by a health care practitioner and found that they made a turnout and a person that was left, you know, to apply for leave, and later on the person will apply for legal aid in order to be assisted with leave. And we are saying that the very same practitioner who bears the fine should be the same practitioner to assist with the appeal, because at least that particular practitioner is vested, you know, with the case. The second amendment relates to civil matters. And in civil matters, the Regional Operations Executive are given a discretion to provide legal aid for a legal matter in a civil matter. Because what we had previously was that a client would qualify for legal aid for one for the matter. So what we have done is we have extended the discretion of the ROEs, but that is limited to instances where the matter will, on a balance of probabilities, have a chance of success, and that the court will justify the benefit to the client. And the other amendment that we are sorting is with regards to maintenance claims. And what we are proposing is that where there is a systematic failure of the maintenance system, either for the applicant to execute or to apply for maintenance, we will provide legal aid where there's been a failure for the system for a period not longer than 12 months, or where there's an abuse of the system by the other party to make it difficult, you know, for the complainant to obtain an order. You know, you find that the person is dodging the system. And I must emphasize that this particular provision, it arose from the seminar that we held in our office when we invited stakeholders and when we discussed the systematic failures of the maintenance system. And the other amendment that we're sorting is to provide legal aid for children estate matters, but where the estate is 1,225, so 125,000, and if where the immovable property is below half a million. And the other amendment that we're also sorting on civil matters is with regards to a merit report, because what we had initially, in a civil case, before you provide legal aid, a merit report is required. So practitioners will provide a merit report. But we look at certain cases where you find that a merit report will not be necessary. So in this type of matters, a merit report will not be necessary. For example, in a simple divorce case, you will not look for a merit report. And also in patient cases, especially where instances can be granted to negotiate with the owner to allow the client to buy some time in the property. Because we feel that in those instances, do not need a merit report. As long as the practitioner can, you know, engage into negotiation with the owner of the property. Also with regards to domestic violence case, especially to protect the interests of the child. And also on administration of estate, because there you are delivering the estate involving the child. And the other amendment that also in several matters that we have extended the authority to judicial practitioners, that is private lawyers, conduct mediation services on behalf of the clients of the legal department. Previously, it was only restricted to our practitioners.
Chair, I come in just to the commissioner, the issues of commissioners of inquiry. We will have known from the media that there has been a lot of debate around this issue, and we thought it was necessary for us to clarify in the guide in terms of Legal Aid South Africa, that we're currently not mandated or funded for commissions of inquiry, but that where we are mandated and funded by the establishing authorities, so whoever establishes the commission, that legal aid then could be provided for the purpose of legal representation of witnesses or persons appearing before the commissions of inquiry, where the commission has certified that they are standing before the commission. We had a specific instance where this did happen in regard to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but where the enabling legislation made very clear that the right to legal representation was there and that the Commission could arrange it either via Legal Aid South Africa or themselves, and that there was separate then funding provided to us to do that. So we thought it was to make it clear overall where we stand in commissions. We've also then suggested that people in there, specifically a discretion, that even where funding is not made available and then subject to us being able to allocate resources or funding, that we can make legal assistance available in exceptional circumstances. And then we list the different issues to be looked at. The person's obviously got to qualify in terms of our means test and indigent. They have to then be certified by the commission as having a proper stand before the commission. That there are prospects of hardship to the person, specifically if assistance is declined. The nature and significance of the evidence to be presented. The extent to which representation is required to enable the inquiry to fulfill its purpose. And then whether the interest of persons will be advanced by any other person associated and certified to appear before the commission. And any other issue of public interest. Specifically here, we're looking at instances where it links more to civil claims, where you have women and children that have lost breadwinners and therefore are not witnesses before the commission and therefore cannot make use of the evidence leaders as witnesses are able to do and don't understand the circumstances under which, specifically in the example that we know, what happened to their loved ones and who to hold liable in terms of their loss of income and loss of support claims. So that's the clarity that we're recommending in terms of commission of inquiries into the guide. Then there are certain miscellaneous issues where we dealt with, specifically Section 204 witnesses, which links more specifically to criminal trials, but where the state convince a co-perpetrator to turn state witness, they are entitled to then an exemption from prosecution if they give full and proper and truthful evidence before the court. But what they have to do to be able to get that exemption is to convince the court that they've actually told the truth and they have been open and honest in terms of the evidence that they have led. It's very difficult for someone to address the court themselves on those ones, and that's why we've had instances where the courts have requested us to appoint. So we're required to make it clear so that just that issue can be argued before the court so that the presiding officer, and it will be mostly in the High Courts, can make the decision to grant the exemption or not. Then in regard to extradition proceedings, specifically here, we found that there are persons that, in instances, been sought to be extradited for offences that they have allegedly committed in other countries. We feel that such persons run the risk of a possibility of facing substantial injustice if they are unrepresented, because such persons may lack the ability to place evidence before the court. To convince the court that the alleged charges does not warrant a prosecution in a foreign court. So what you find is someone standing there, they're not able to assist themselves. Although this is not a criminal trial, it does happen in your magistrate's courts mostly, before your magistrates that preside in criminal matters, but it's a unique proceeding. It's not a criminal proceeding or a civil proceeding. But here you've got to then assist someone to then convince the court that it doesn't warrant prosecution. And then the last issue is, we provide that where we do provide representation in extradition proceedings, that if we use private practitioners, not our own practitioners, the tariffs that are set out in Annexure F, which are civil tariffs, will apply to practitioners in those instances.
Thank you. With regard to the supply chain management policy, this amendment deals with the procurement of legal services to ensure that it complies with treasury practice and our supply chain management policy. And this has influenced the investigation units, cooperation agreements, and when you give instructions to the care practitioners. And in addition to the current requirements that we have, the following information must be submitted by organizations for the purpose of cooperation agreement and to render investigation services. It is the proponent's name, address, identification or registration number, identification of any confidential or proprietary data, not really public, the proponent's current suspect's clearance certificate, a declaration of interest containing particulars set out in SBD 4 issued by National Treasury, a declaration from the proponent that they said that the offering of unsolicited proposal was not a result of any non-public information obtained from officials of the relevant institution or any other institution. And the issue of the supply chain management was also reviewed with regards to social care practitioners. And what we have done is we have looked at the allocation of social care instructions so that we should design it to comply with certain BEE principles and to ensure equitable distribution of fee income while remaining competitive and cost effective by means of these legal actions. Because we've got a set of terms that we review annually where we pay to the care practitioners from. And what we've done is we have also looked at the accreditation program as to how are you going to accredit to the care practitioners. And we have revised that accreditation program to include the following. That practitioners must be in a good standing with the relevant professional body at the time of registration and must inform us of any subsequent changes. Because sometimes you find that you accredit a practitioner today and you know after some few time that particular practitioner may be struck off the road or may be suspended. So the onus is on them to inform us of any change of circumstances. And also that practitioners must be possessing of a vehicle clearance certificate at the time of registration. And they must submit a vehicle clearance certificate to remain accredited. So in case where the tax clearance expire, you know, while they're busy dealing with the matter, they have to apply for a new one and give us the updated one. And as the Association of Advocates, not listed, must obtain recognition from legal aid estate before any member of such associations can be accredited. So here we are trying to ensure that the advocates that will receive the sessions are accredited. And that any misrepresentation will be reported to the relevant professional body as a result of the practitioner from the accreditation list. So what we'll do is, if we remove a practitioner from the list, we'll make sure that that's reported to the relevant body. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. And the last one is dealing specifically then with the means test. We're not seeking any significant or any changes to the means test in terms of the amounts, either in terms of income or in terms of assets. But what we've clarified in that is the procedure to follow for an applicant following a criminal matter to plead against a refusal of legal aid where the means test has been exceeded. And so we've clarified the process to be followed. You find quite significantly, specifically in criminal trials, we must understand that the means test is an easy administrative manner in which we can confirm whether someone is indigent or not. But the Constitution, in terms of the interpretation and the court's interpretation of substantial injustice, requires us to consider whether someone's able to afford the cost of their legal representation. So what you do find in some matters, although they exceed the means test, the ability to afford the means, the cost of the legal representation is impossible due to the lengthy duration of a trial and therefore the exorbitant cost of a trial. So the longer a trial runs, the more expensive it becomes, the less likely someone's able to afford it. And so our constitutional requirement is that we must look at the question as to whether they're able to afford or not. So what we don't do is we don't leave these decisions to be at the justice centres. It comes to a national committee to consider these applications where they exceed the means test, but there's going to be a significant, there could be substantial injustice because they're still not able to afford the costs. What we've done as part of that then is to develop a contribution policy and a procedure to recover any contributions, whereby we don't say despite the fact that you see the means test will give you legal aid and you don't have to contribute. We require then that we look at the income and the levels and the duration of the case and this policy then sets out what contribution should be made in defined circumstances by anyone who's granted legal aid who exceeds the means test as set down. And then the final amendment is that the legal aid tariffs, we review them annually and we look at them to align with inflation. Our tariffs are below commercial competitive rates, but that is so because we need to remain sustainable, but we don't say that someone can't make a fair living on the tariffs that we set up. But we try and we annually make sure that we keep pace with inflation, otherwise it will lag behind. And so in this instance, a 5.3% increase from 1st of April 2013 in line with the average inflation at that time that we calculated. And that's in both criminal and civil matters. And those the amendments that we are seeking to the legal aid chair. I don't know if you want me to go with the concluding comments, and then you can take questions thereafter. Chair, I'm in your hands. Just two things, Chair. Well, I can deal with them very quickly and succinctly, Chair. Obviously, what is critical, and we've seen, I'm sure all the members will have seen internationally the strain on which legal aid schemes are coming internationally, both in terms of civil legal aid and the cuts to civil legal aid budgets and to legal aid budgets overall. This guide is critical for us and is essential to render effective and efficient legal aid on a sustainable basis. It sets out clearly in what types of matters we assist, where we don't, or where we limit what we assist in, the types of cases we assist in, who we will assist, who we won't assist, that we require merits in civil cases. So it's a critical document in ensuring the sustainability of Legal Aid South Africa as an organisation. And we've prided ourselves, and I'm sure we'll present to this committee, I know we're presenting next week Wednesday to the Portfolio Committee our annual report, to once again in our 11th year of an unqualified and clean audit. So we're proud about, in terms of as an organisation, how we've managed the public funds and taxpayer monies that have been entrusted to us. So the committee, we request to recommend that the 2000 legal aid guide be ratified by, in this instance, the National Council of Provinces, as required by Section 3, Capital A 2 of the Legal Aid Act of 1969. And Chair, those are our submissions, and we're happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Clarity, Honourable Rule.
Thank you very much, Chair, and you know, Chair, noticed that the progressiveness upon which the Legal Aid South Africa has been, you know, through since our term, in terms of seeking to better, you know, the service that they offer to citizens through progressively, you know, try and find solutions, and the solutions are all to be able to make sure that the service itself is appropriate to the beneficiaries of the service. So I think that it is of a worth noting. Then secondly, Chair, you know, we now have a new content advisor. I think, as part of the legacy of into the new term, this is what we've agreed with the judge, I think, last year, that, you know, from time to time, we would meet the Legal Aid South Africa on the general work. For instance, I'm not sure if we share for the annual report with them, so we are able to engage with them on broad matters. But it's on our side that we would have to look at the importance of our program and consider, you know, ongoing and more engagements with the Legal Aid South Africa. Chair, the only civil matters I wanted to clarify questions. One, I think I welcome to the first one on the first amendment that is proposed, and I think it's a good proposal. I don't have the documents, so I'll just talk broadly in the areas, and I'm sure they will match them on the document. The ones on the GDK care practitioner, having concluded the matter, and then at a later stage, the leave to appeal. And they are saying that they would use the same practitioner. Is it limited to, or if it does allow a scope where perhaps that person, I know that the intention is that because there's a relationship and there's a conclusion on the matter that was dealt with, either way. But if somebody, by any other reason, is not satisfied with that practitioner, does this amendment allow that another person be appointed for leave to appeal? I understand the rationale of the person understanding the matters and everything else, factors and everything else in the first instance on the matter that was said, but there might be difference in terms of interest on taking the appeal. It's a flexibility. The other matter, Chair, is it because of the means test on the matter of the ethics? You mentioned figures there, and you said on the immovable, it's 500,000 and that kind of thing. So I'm saying, is it because, or I don't know what, for now, is it a cost? It's an affordability matter or issue. If the United States, the immovable property involved is about 500, or is it, I'm trying to understand better the rationale there in the size 500,000 in particular, because houses, we might find that now it's an RDP house, and you might find that it's an indicia that, but the house that is being contested there is a 2-3 million rent as escrow. Now the third one, Chair, relates to the additional consideration on the civil matter. As I said, I'm not talking to them on any order. I have no benefit of the paper, of the document, so I'm talking as they come to my mind. And on that additional matter, on additional support, it's an additional support on another matter. I think I hear it that way, which means you can have two cases that are supported in practical terms in a certain matter, two cases that are supported and there are limitations to that. So the point is that there are two matters that if they could perhaps try and practicalize that in terms of if they do have some example there, so that we are able to understand better, because they haven't got a number of clients. Affordability might be a question. If you find that all your beneficiaries are having 1-2 meters, one or two or other additional meters on maintenance matter, the issue is that that amendment there on the maintenance matters, does this, is not limited to, because as you said that it emanates from stakeholders, could be that, I don't know, let's say, could be that the matters were raised by supposedly on the presumption that women are the sufferers on this and all that. But of late, we know very well that sometimes other people feel that they are improperly garnished and want to take matters into court, but they do qualify. Are they taken care of by that consideration in the maintenance matter? So, meaning that would be a man that feels that they, without a default, and he does qualify in terms of the minister, you might be earning 5,000 rand, and then but we have a garnish order that was improperly imposed and it's affecting that person. Can that person benefit? It's the flexibility as well of that consideration. On the commissions of inquiry, Chair, the last part, I think, Patrick read public interest. Hey, I would like to really understand, Chair. I know that you tried to explain, but you see, he convinced me when then he started to say, in terms of loss of in arms, loss of loved ones that were the breadwinners and all of that. So, I'm trying to say, what is then the coverage of that? I mean, public interest, in what context? Public interest in the context of losing income, or in the public context, in public interest in the context of those people, because I thought that they were having it right when they're saying when there's going to be any substantial injustice or that kind of thing. But I mean, if we take the examples of the Magana Commission, where widows want to listen what happened to their loved ones. I mean, it is a public interest matter. So must they be covered then? Is that what this amendment is about? That consideration on public interest is about? To say, because I want to hear what happened to my cousin, brother, or whoever, and I'm representing the family, I must listen how my lawyer acts. Is that so? How can they properly contextualize me that part? Let me stop here. I think I had one or two others that have just slipped my mind. But thank you.
No, I think, Chair, let me start with the last point that has been raised, the Marikana one, around public interest. You see, we hear that because the Bulamach case has got an element around public interest. No. And I want the same, this issue still clarified to me in terms of the way my colleague has raised it. These people have got money. Legal aid is funding them. The employees of that mining company don't have money. Legal aid is refusing to fund them. Now, I'm not sure, you see, in terms of public interest, what do you mean? What is it that you want to bring to ourselves? Because if you take the Burma, there are farm owners, there are factory owners, there are millionaires, some of them. This one's any less than 5,000 per month. But the element around public interest is almost the same. And it goes further to loss of income, loss of what, loss of, you know, all those issues. How do you determine? I have seen internationalists being assisted by legal aid, whilst poor local people are not assisted by legal aid. How do you come to the determination? Yesterday I asked one issue to the police.
Is it the country first, or the people in the country first, then internationalists later? If Diwan is brought down to South Africa tomorrow, you will be the first to hunt Diwan demand. Now I'm just saying, how do is our national interest coming first, or is the international picture you want to portray internationally coming first to yourself? What is it that you want to bring forward?
Honourable members, I think that other party members will be attending party meetings, and I'm afraid that if we lose them, we don't go to correct.
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. If I can deal with Mr. Nzimande's issues. On the GK practitioner side, we've got to understand the process is that if anyone wants to appeal, we've got procedures in terms of the our guide and accreditation with our practitioners. That as soon as if a client is convicted and sentenced, we must immediately inquire from them and explain their rights to apply for leave to appeal, and that they must make an election whether they want to do. If they make that election, then the practitioner must proceed to bring that application for leave to appeal, and if that's not successful, a petition for leave, which ultimately, if either of those two are decided in their favour, they will then get an appeal. Sometimes it happens that clients don't make that election up front, and they make it later. And all we're trying to do is regulate that the person that dealt with the case at that time, who has more intimate knowledge, will then deal with that application for leave of appeal. What you do find is invariably, once the matter goes on appeal and it goes to the High Court, there are different practitioners allocated because the High Court is not normally in the same area or jurisdiction of where the magistrate's court is.
Just a moment. Let me request the members whether we should follow a particular principle so that those of us who remain can be kept by those other courts. Can we, or the question that I asked, will they have a gain in terms of the adoption or its modality? So the people just replied that was 2 minutes ago, and then we'll have a room.
We don't have measure issues with the issues raised before us. We just wanted clarity, but we can move with the adoption so that if matters are to be clarified, they can be clarified in the letters.
Chair, I can finish in 2 minutes if that would assist the committee.
Chair, I want to move to the adoption.
Any objection? Objection. Can I read this? Report of the State Committee of Secretary of Development on the draft presentation with an API scheduled for approval by Parliament dated 9 October 2020. The State Committee of Secretary of Development, having considered the subject of the draft 2020 legal aid guide, referred to it, recommends that the Minister of Council of Parliament approve the draft 2020 legal aid guide. The report to be considered. Agreed. Thank you very much. Honourable members, you can quickly go to the meeting of your week before the week reaches.
Chair, in terms of the agenda, I see there are a number of minutes that must be adopted. If we can deal with that situation, because I think we need to adopt them.
The minutes
and reports.
Don't we have another minutes can be suspended, but there are two reports that are important.
Yeah, Chair, I wanted to, in terms of the reports, but we move that we adopt the two reports and the minutes can be dealt with in nomination.
Is it correct, sir?
The domestic violence report and the APP report.
And if I got not to that, so the Honourable President, Marvin, support, and objection, now the two reports are adopted. And therefore the minutes will be dealt with next session. Thank you very much for that, it was my idea. I'm not sure if we're going to do a free case.
I call for the agenda of the meeting.
So I think that I just might look at it to the right. And I'll point them to the thing that I have to put it. This is from the Hello? Don't worry about that.